Please be advised that this episode of Australian True Crime contains descriptions of graphic violence and is not appropriate for children.
And I truly believe someone out there knows something because, again, I don't believe someone has taken them and never said anything to anybody. Nobody saw anything. That's, you know, we're talking six people here and no one saw anything. No one knows anything.
It's always hard to believe that shocking crimes so publicly executed can remain mysterious. But in this case, it's even more so because there's currently a $6 million reward up for grabs for information leading to an arrest in the cases of six women abducted and murdered in the Frankston and Tynong North area of Melbourne in 1980 and 1981.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. Come with us as we go beyond the news cycle to find out how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
One of the victims of the Frankston and Tynong North killings was 14-year-old schoolgirl Catherine Headland. Her two best friends, Cheryl and Vicky, and John, the boyfriend she'd spent the afternoon with before her abduction, have tried valiantly to keep Catherine's face in the media, in the hopes it will encourage someone to come forward with information. They even participated in the TV show Sensing Murder, in which psychics were brought in to work on unsolved cases. But there was a cruel twist there as well. They'll tell us about that experience later in this episode, but first, our very own Emily Webb, who wrote about the case in her book Suburban Nightmares, fills us in on some background.
This case is one that a lot of people remember. It was more than 30 years ago, but it's one of those cases that people are like, when is that going to get solved? And it's known as the Tynong North and Frankston killings. Over the course of a couple of years, there were six women found murdered, four in Tynong North, which is out near Gippsland. Mm-hmm. And then two women in Frankston. And
so you're actually talking about a serial killer, potentially.
Potentially a serial killer, but okay. There's also some theories that it's two killers. But today we have Vicky and Cheryl who have come in to speak to us. And now Vicky and Cheryl are the childhood best friends of one of the young victims, Catherine Headland. And Catherine was only 14 when she disappeared. She was on her way to work, you know, catching the bus to her part-time job at Coles in Fountain Gate in Narre Warren, and she disappeared in 1980. So she disappeared on the 28th of August, and then in December, her body was found along with two other women in Tynong North in shallow graves. The case has recently got a lot more publicity because Victoria Police announced a massive reward.
Oh, wow.
So $1 million for each, if people could give information for each of the six victims. So in total, it's potentially $6 million reward.
Wow.
And Cheryl actually took part in that press conference. She spoke on behalf of the Headland family. Thanks for coming in, Cheryl and Vicky. And I just want you to talk to us a bit about that day that Catherine disappeared and just...
I'm really interested in like what sort of community it was that you were in, that you were growing up in at that time.
It was very quiet and very safe, we thought. It was dirt road, quiet area. We used to play in the park all the time. And
sort of area where you knew everybody?
Yeah. So we lived within blocks of each other on the same street. And so,
Hang out. There was a group of us that used to hang out after school all weekend. You know, we were very, very close. And all the kids our age within the couple of blocks of each other all hung out together. It was, you know, we were pretty tight-knit, weren't we? Mm.
Mm. You all went to school together?
Yeah.
So how many kids were there in the group?
Oh, various at times. It could be
about six of us, wasn't there?
Six to ten of us.
Mm. Yeah. So, yeah, what do you remember of the day that Catherine disappeared?
I don't remember a lot. The funny thing is that anything I've tried to recall about her going missing is very vague to me. But I always remember the first day I saw her, and I always remember the first day I met her. And I just think it's my mind just blocking out what I don't want to know about. So,
well, that's interesting. Tell us about the first day you met her.
Well, that was at primary school. She had moved to Berwick over school holidays, and we had seen her riding past our house on the bike, and she had a dog tied to the handlebars and piggy tails, and we sort of, you know, making a little bit of fun of her when she was riding past because we didn't know this new kid sort of thing. And then after the school holidays, she turned up in my classroom. So it was a grade 5-6 composite. So that's how we ended up in the same grade because she was a year older. Mm. But basically you were given a buddy to look after you at school, and another girl was her buddy, and I basically walked up at morning tea and sort of said, I know you, you live around the corner, and we were friends from then on. So, but yeah, like I said, I remember that as clear as day, but her going missing, very vague.
And I always think probably afterwards, like, the facts of the case become so, like, you would hear them and repeat them so many times that that might supersede your actual memory of it. Mm-hmm. Is that the case, do you think? Yeah. So do you remember the last time you saw her?
Last time I saw her would have been because she went missing during the school holidays, and I actually went away for school holidays for the first week, and that's when she disappeared. So it would have been at school on the Friday before the school holiday started. And we.
So do you remember when you heard that she was missing? Did you hear on your holidays?
When I came back, it was 2 days after she went missing, and we had actually planned to go away one day. I can't remember where, it was something to do with a horse. And so I rang her house up and, you know, said, her dad answered the phone, and I said, oh, Mr. Headland, is Catherine there, please? And he goes, no, she's not. And I said, oh, do you know where she is? And he said, no, we don't.
Oh, wow.
And that was the end of that conversation. And then I saw Johnny, her boyfriend, and he told me what had happened. So, yeah, it wasn't a very nice time at all. Mm.
And I remember seeing photos, and I think we used them in some of the articles I wrote. You know, the police did a reconstruction of Catherine, what she was wearing on the day, because she went missing really from a bus stop, didn't she? The last person to see her would have been John, her boyfriend, waving her off. Can you tell us a bit about what you know about that day from obviously John and the police and the media?
Basically, John has never forgiven himself for not walking her to the bus stop that day. Normally, he would be walking her across the road. Apparently, he was feeling a bit ill that day and sort of just said goodbye to her at the door, and that was the last anyone saw of her. So whether she actually made it to the bus stop and got across the highway, because I just sort of a vision in my mind, which is that she's possibly, you would go across a diagonal to get to the bus stop. Somebody's driven down Princess Highway, seen her waiting to cross the road, or seen her sitting in the bus stop and just taken her.
John had a photo with you for the Leader newspaper article I did, and it was a really big deal for you both to do that. And you had it at the park where you used to all hang out. And I remember John was only able to communicate with me through text message and through you, just because he is still so shattered about it. But such a burden to carry, because he was only he was a kid as well, wasn't he? And you just don't expect, you know, what was it, 100, 200 metres to the bus stop, you know, to go missing.
Yeah.
And no sightings of her between his place and the bus stop.
Well, there was reported sightings, but I don't believe that they were her.
What about you, Vicky?
No, there's been quite a few people who came forward within, the couple of weeks after she went missing to say that they had sighted her, but none of them were actually consistent with each other. So I tend to think that maybe a lot of people are just saying it for the sake of saying it.
Because we truly believe that if she'd, as I said to you, you know, if she got on the bus, she would have got to Fountain Gate. There's no reason for her to get off the bus. Like I said, she had her mother to face if she didn't turn up to work. So if she got on the bus, she should have, by all, you know, means, arrived at Fountain Gate safely. So.
And you both pretty firmly believe that she would not have gotten in a car with anyone.
Definitely.
Not a friend, not anyone who pulled over and said, I'll give you a lift to work.
No. Well, she was only 14, so having friends old enough to drive was sort of unrealistic. And she wouldn't have got into a car with a stranger. There's no way known, you know. And she wasn't a slight little girl. She was slender and all that, but she was a horse rider. She had strong legs. She would have beaten the crap out of anyone who tried to take her into a car. And I firmly believe that she would have fought like crazy. So I honestly believe it would have been, she would have been forced in. There would have been more than one person.
Wow. I mean, at the time when she was still considered missing, you were home from holidays, Vicky and Cheryl, you were still, around the corner from her house. What was everyone thinking and saying at that time? People think she'd run away or?
No, we didn't.
We knew she didn't, yeah. I mean, they thought because her parents had a bit of a thing with her having to get a job to because she had a horse, Prince, that she absolutely loved. So her parents thought that she was old enough to start contributing towards the upkeep of a horse, so hence the job, and people thought that maybe that's why she might have run away in that. But she was happy. She had a great life.
She really knew it. Such a shame.
Parents had just built an extension on the house for her. She had her own bedroom upstairs. She was happy.
Sounds like a pretty normal teenager.
Yeah, exactly.
And with John became a bit of a focus, didn't he, for the police investigation, which I guess is understandable when they're trying to eliminate. But I know John's, very reluctant to speak about it because it's so still so devastating for him. But what can you recall of those weeks and months until she was actually found? What was happening?
I think we were all in disbelief that it actually had happened. We would, just hang out together after school of a night time and just think about where she was. I mean, I never in my wildest dreams expected this as the outcome. I don't know what we thought would be the outcome, but we never thought that, 37 years later we would still be wondering who had killed her and what had actually happened.
Yeah, so, I can understand. It must have been a bizarre situation to be in when no outcome seems logical.
No, because we were only children.
Yeah.
Realistically, we were 13.
And we thought we were safe.
Yeah, we were in our little bubble. And
were police talking to you kids? They weren't interviewing you and asking you?
They did when they found her.
Yeah, that was a little bit different.
And that was about, so we'll go to that point. So later in the year, in December. Of 1980.
Mm. When did she go missing, sorry?
August of the 1980.
Months of waiting.
Mm.
And then do you remember how you found out that?
I found out on the news, actually. I still remember hearing it.
Mum actually rang the police when she heard it was on the news, it was the body found, and I know that my mother rang the police and said she thought it sounded like it might be Catherine, and it turned out to be her from dental records, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And her and two other ladies, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And they had they found there was a leather
strap.
Band strap around her ankle. Yeah. So they were able to identify her.
That she
from
always
that.
Wore? Was that?
Yeah. Well, the stupid thing is that it was a fashion thing, wasn't it, Vicky, that we all had that. And where we got that leather was from my dad's bootlaces. So we used to go to dad's bootlaces and cut the leather
cut
up. And
wow.
Hers, and she was the only one that was still wearing it, really, wasn't she? It was a fad thing, and it had got really thin.
Mm.
And when the police come to the house about, the leather and stuff, I had to go find some of Dad's bootlaces so that they could compare it. But,
bizarre.
Dad didn't like us for that, but we used to steal little bootlaces.
How they were found, the victims were, there were hunters out in this part of very secluded, only people who really knew that area or had a reason to, like these hunters would be around that area, and they sort of stumbled across the first remains, which was a young girl called Anne-Marie Sargent, who was 18, and she went missing from Dandenong. So she was, I think, on her way to a job seeker centre in Dandenong. She went missing. And then
and the other remains belonged to a 75-year-old woman.
Yeah, so Bertha Miller.
Extraordinary.
It does. And she was actually the auntie of the then Police Chief Commissioner Mick Miller. So she'd gone missing on her way to church in, I think it was Ivanhoe or Kew, around that area. Right. She was basically getting a tram, and she went missing. And this is where it's really, really strange, this case. But so the remains of these three women were found. And then also there was some remains of another victim, not in that exact space, but on the side of the road called Narromole Stevenson. She was a young woman who went missing from Brunswick. I think she was from Thailand, yes, but was married to an Australian. Mm-hmm. She'd gone missing, and it was actually an ex-VFL footballer who had stopped on the side of the road and then noticed this bone. And so this is all – so these women were all grouped together. There were also two women in Frankston, two older women in their 50s who went missing, you know, in the middle of the day and were found in Sky Road in Frankston. So it's always been put together, these cases, but, you know, there's theories that it could be two separate killers.
These crimes are unsolved. Yes. They remain unsolved.
Yes.
To this day. So what are your theories? You've lived with this for over 30 years. I'm sure you've thought about it every day of your lives. And I know you're both still active. You have a Facebook group.
Yes.
You're both still active in trying to keep the case front of mind. What are your theories? What do you think?
It's quite hard because there's so many people who will throw different things at you.
And you
just suddenly look at things from a different perspective. As a young child, I was only 13 at the time, I had no idea. I didn't even think up until 15 years ago that Catherine would have been
sexually assaulted.
You know, to me, I was just so immature that it just didn't even occur.
So do we know
me.
That happened, or we don't
well,
know?
Well, we don't know for right. sure,
was,
but
that
they
Bert Miller was found with clothes on, yes, and Catherine, yeah, and Anne-Marie weren't.
Yes. Okay. So okay. They presume that they would have been.
Okay.
But so you've got to think of, was it a sexual predator? But then there's Bertha, who wasn't, you know, wouldn't have been, you know, she was fully clothed. So
yeah, and had no links to the other girls. No. So it's a very, very strange.
And the other girls didn't have any links to each other, right? So none of the victims have links to each other.
No, they don't believe so.
So at 13, you don't have really a theory because it's all too terrifying and confusing. Mm.
Yes.
But now
it's even more confusing because there's people coming left, right and centre and throwing new ideas at you and new thoughts, and that makes you think outside the square of what's normal.
So, logical.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. I personally don't have any theories. I personally would just – yeah, I quite come to a blank when I think of what's or who it could be. I can't put a name to it. You know, the police often or the media often talk about one particular person who of interest in Frankston who they think might have done the Frankston murders. Mr. Brown. Mr. Brown.
If he's still alive, and I believe he is, he's well into his 80s. And so the two women who went missing in Frankston were Alison Rook and Joy Summers. And so Joy Summers, the links between them is they were waiting for buses. They're in their mid-50s. And this they were both found, their bodies dumped in Sky Road in Frankston. Now, the suspect who has always been seen as being pretty good for this was a person who was known to offer lifts to women often. He knew the area well. He was a projectionist, like an outdoor cinema projectionist, and he knew the area. But I think where the case for the police fell down is his wife, who from my research is now deceased, had given him an alibi for one of the things, and actually – but he, you know, it was a false alibi, they believe. But he had been failed polygraph tests. He seemed to, from the reporting I've read, and John Sylvester from The Age has done a lot of reporting on this over the years, he seemed to almost revel in his status as a suspect for this. So he's sort of thought to be, you know, the one who did the Frankston murders, but there's just no link between these ladies in Frankston and the women in Tynong North, the girls in
Apart
Tynong.
Apart from timing, is that fair to say? That they're all waiting for public transport.
Yeah, that's about the only
I think
thing.
It's because it all happened around the same time, like the Joy and Alison were, it was in 1980 and 1981 that it happened. So it's all around the same time, but it's just really baffling.
I think that's more coincidence than anything.
Yeah. Cheryl, do you have any theories? Where are you at right now with it?
Well, I don't think it's anyone that we know, just because of the distance between and that there's no link. So if you say it's someone that we know that knew Catherine and she got in the car with them, well, what's the link to the other people?
Mm-hmm.
I just think it was a person that took people because they were there.
An opportunist.
They were basically there. And how they got away with it, taking so many people in broad daylight, is beyond me. But I have no theories on it really either, other than it's a random person that took them because they could. And I truly believe someone out there knows something because, again, I don't believe someone has taken them and never said anything to anybody. Nobody saw anything. That's, you know, we're talking six people here and no one saw anything. No one knows anything.
And that lines up what you said with something that was reported from a 1985 police analysis of the murders, and it was revealed in a 1999 Age article. And I'll just read this out. I covered it in my book. So the analysis said, there's nothing to suggest that the offender or offenders selected their victims because of specific characteristics common to the women. It appears that each of them was selected at random. Who they were was not the criteria for their selection, but where they were.
That's right. You know, like if Catherine hadn't have been crossing Princes Highway at that time and that person passing her, she could still well be here.
That's so, an opportunistic offender is, I think it's quite rare in that absolutely. Term, I think, according to what they say. But it just certainly makes no sense, does it?
It certainly does not. But there are a number of strange aspects to this case, including some bizarre letters and cards. We'll hear more about that after the break. Coming up on Australian True Crime, behind the scenes on Sensing Murder. But first, what keeps Cheryl and Vicky involved in Catherine's murder all these years later?
I had contacted the police and was just asking them, what's happening with it, because every now and then we try to touch base and sort of make sure someone's still doing something, because we don't want it to ever go away until it's solved. And the police officer that I'd spoken to said it wasn't really talking to me, and I just sort of said, I'm ringing on behalf of the Headlands, just, what's going on? And I said, they never hear anything. And basically he said, do you have contact with them? And I said, well, yes, I do. And asked for their details, and I don't give out their details, so I checked in with them myself and made sure it was okay to give the phone number and that. And it was basically to inform them about the press conference coming up, and did they want somebody in the family to go for them. And basically it's come back to, they said for me to go on their behalf, and so that's how I ended up involved with that.
Do you feel comfortable talking to us about the family in terms of just about their process since this happened in 1980?
We've kept contact, but there's not a lot said.
Okay.
And the other thing is that I feel that Vicky and I both front the media and the press and the questions on their behalf, because they do not want to be contacted, and they don't want anything to do with it really, other than hopefully, of course they still hope it's going to be solved.
Because there was a very cruel thing that happened to them about 9 years after the murder. Some strange letters were sent to police and also to the Headlands, a card, a Christmas card that was handwritten, and it was like almost taunting them, wasn't it?
Yeah.
About, about the crime. And it was
do you remember that?
Yeah.
That time? What was that?
It was stating that you never found Catherine's earrings and, just some personal stuff.
And was that true?
I believe so.
So, I think the writer of the...
Yeah, the Bluebird ones. And no, they didn't find them. They had her hairbrush and they had that piece of leather. But
so was that kind of information that would only be known to...
They believe so. I mean, so it was a typed letter that went to the police, and I think the Christmas card was, I believe, handwritten. But the writer had addressed it to the then Chief Commissioner, Kel Glare. And it was basically saying, did you find the brooch that Miller was wearing on the day of her murder? That was Bertha Miller. Or the pair of sterling silver bluebird earrings belonging to Catherine. And so I think that piqued the police's interest because that was never made public. The writer also kept taunting the police saying, have you run into a dead end? Need some help. And then in December 1988, someone sent a Christmas card to Catherine's mother boasting that this killer would make Adelaide's Truro murders look like kids' stuff. So the Truro murders were in the late 70s. They murdered a series of women, and then the murder stopped when the man Christopher Worrell was killed in a car accident. So it was just very strange, and I don't think they've ever been able to find out who wrote those letters. They did trace a typewriter back to prison. Yeah. So whether or not someone in prison was you know, paid or something, or I don't know how it all works to write it, but it just certainly was a really strange twist in that case. Yeah. And cruel, so cruel to, you know, do that to people.
How did your parents cope when you've got 13-year-old girls who have living through this terrifying, strange, talk about growing up quickly, suddenly?
Yeah.
How did your lives change?
My parents more or less tried to put locks on the doors and bars on the windows, but, you know, we managed to get out. They tried to wrap us up in cotton wool, but I think as a group of kids, we banded together and we tried to, I suppose, comfort each other, support each other. I think as young kids, we were all very supportive of each other, but yeah, our lives changed, yeah, big time. Very.
Did it change the way you parented
definitely,
yourself?
Definitely.
So what? Tell us about that.
I think, my children, their upbringing was probably a lot different to mine. I was a lot more stricter with them. My daughter, Catherine, I was pretty strict on her. She wasn't allowed to catch public transport. That was one thing I was really quite strict on. I would, even as young adults, drop my kids off at parties and pick them up at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, you know. That's what I would do.
Well, you named your daughter Catherine after.
I did, yeah.
Your friend Catherine Headland.
Yes.
And so, and I know that your daughter works on the Facebook page for you and all that kind of stuff. Do you have kids, Cheryl?
Yeah, two.
Have they grown up with this as a big part of their lives as well?
Yeah. They've known who she is all their life.
Yeah.
Same thing as Vicky just said. It was strict. They weren't allowed anywhere. They weren't allowed to go anywhere.
Yeah.
So
I think as a parent who I haven't lived through anything like you have, but I'm constantly trying to think about how to make them alert but not alarmed, if you know what I mean, about the world around them. I don't want them to be afraid of the world or afraid of people, but to know that things can happen. How do you try and keep them still, give them some confidence in the world?
I don't think I did. I think I did make them scared of the world and scared of people and don't trust anybody.
Okay.
I mean, you can't catch a bus. That's not hitchhiking on the side of the road. That's catching a bus.
Mm.
I did make them scared.
And also, I mean, not, you know, she wasn't 7. She was 14 and she was a strong girl, and it was a trip I'm just sure she made 100 times. And
you used to always catch public transport everywhere in those days, you know.
And it makes you think of I was talking the other night, you know, the 13-year-old girl who went missing in Boronia, Siriboon, and she was the same. She was just walking to school and just seems to have disappeared off the face of the earth. And it's these cases, I think, that really make you second guess, I guess, wanting to let your kids just move into the world. Mm. But
So what message do you have for people listening? Is there anything that you sort of put out there to try and trigger memories or to, you know, is there any message that goes along with these huge rewards?
All I keep saying is that someone out there knows something.
Yeah.
Mm. You know, it's been 37 years and so many lives have been changed and adjusted. So many people have been hurt and continue to be hurt by this. I know Cheryl and I are always thinking of Catherine. And the impact that it's had on our life is huge. So speak up, ring Crime Stoppers, you know, get the $6 million. It's yours for the taking, you know.
And the letter and the card say someone knows something. Someone knows. And it's, you know, it's not just Catherine and Catherine's family. From being at the press conference and hearing the other families speak as well.
Who did you meet? Who was there at the press
there
conference?
There was a representative for every family other than the Millers.
Yep.
But they were talking like it was yesterday and the media seemed to be quite surprised at the pain still being so raw and the memories still being so clear. And, you know, they were saying, you know, it's been over 30 years, it's 37 years and you still feel like that. Yes, yes, we do.
Well, I imagine some of those journalists there probably wouldn't have even been alive when that case happened, you know.
Yeah.
But they really did seem surprised that the pain was still there. They, you know, it doesn't fade, it doesn't go away, and it's not just Catherine.
Yeah, and I think what Michelle and I are learning more and more talking to people is just the shock and the it's like the secondary impact that filters out from something like this.
Yeah, the ripple effect.
Yeah, the ripple effect, you know, so it's not just the immediate family or the husband or the children who are affected. It's like the friends, it's the colleagues, you know, it's quite shattering.
Definitely.
And I think more people are learning about PTSD and the effects that has on people.
Yeah, well, you'd never think of it, but it does. It has a huge effect.
I mean, just on the way you both, you know, interacted with your kids about safety, that's an effect of, you know, having lived through this.
That's it, yeah. Yeah, and my daughter, Catherine, she has three daughters who all know who Catherine is. And, I mean, they've never met her. My daughter never met her. But they all know who she is. They, you know, well, the grandchildren don't know exactly what happened to her, but they know something terrible happened to her and, you know, and that will go on and on and on through the generations too. So
do you think do you have any idea why now the police offered that reward? Is it because – I guess it's 37 years and maybe suspects are getting older, people's memories are fading. Do you have any idea of why now?
No, I know that, you know, we sent in some letters to ask them to do that and I'm not 100% sure.
As well.
That's right, yeah.
And a lot of old cases have been solved.
Yes. Absolutely. So, Kylie Mabry.
Every time we hear one, it's like, well, maybe next one will be Catherine's, and maybe that's what inspired it, that I think some of those cases were solved from increasing the reward or publicity, you know, so maybe they just thought that this one was a good one to try again.
And if you, through the Facebook page, you know, it's a really amazing channel for contact. Yes. Have you made contact with some of the other victims' families through that?
Yes, we have, yes. And there's quite a few who are, you know, very supportive of the Facebook group and, you know, contact us quite regularly. Mm-hmm. So that's really good.
Yeah.
Isn't it amazing that that we would think that it wouldn't hurt as much 37 years later, like that people would be shocked by that. Yeah. I mean, I just can't imagine what a hole that leaves in your life when someone disappears and then you find out that they've met a violent end and you don't know how or why or who or I can't imagine that ever healing.
No.
Or feeling any better.
And I think with every part of your life, you know, you grow up, you get your car license, you get married, you have children, all that, and then you think, but Catherine never got that. Or, you know, Anne-Marie, she never went through that either. And those lives have been cut short.
Yeah,
and you don't know why, you know, could have.
Children left without their mums, like the ladies in Frankston. I think one of the ladies, her son was a police officer
Ivan,
in South Australia. Yeah. And, you know, it's just so unexpected.
That's right. And his children haven't got a grandmother. Yeah. And it just goes on and on. It's just not fair.
No, it's not, and it doesn't go away. I mean, we know that closure is a silly word in a lot of ways because it doesn't bring her back if you find out what happened to her, but it just seems to make a big difference.
I think people need answers. They deserve answers. The parents, Catherine's parents, you know, and her brother, they deserve to have answers as to who did it. I mean, we're never going to know why.
No.
And you don't want to know how, but you just want to know who.
And do you still keep in contact with John a bit?
He hasn't moved on. No. I don't. He never will. He's held himself accountable for that, you know, for all of it, you know, for the past 37 years, as I've said. He just hasn't. He's tried to move on, but very unsuccessfully.
So you did a Sensing Murder episode, which was the show where clairvoyant psychics would come and investigate cold cases. And Deb Webber was your lady.
John and myself were involved in doing that. Again, it was to get publicity out there.
Yeah. Well, there's no reason not to do it, I suppose.
Well, you know, the only reason I wouldn't do it is if it was going against the family wishes, which it wasn't.
Yeah.
So, again, it was just another form of publicity. It was a very popular series.
I loved it.
So, didn't we all?
Yes.
And so, anyway, it turns out that we did do the episode and there is a copy. You could see it online and I have a copy myself.
You can get it on YouTube if you're Google. Yeah. That's how but, I saw it.
Because it didn't air.
No, it was actually advertised to be aired twice. And never went to air. And it wasn't until years later that Vicky said to me, yes, there's an injunction on it and someone stopped it going to air.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's my question. And I've been trying to find out who and why, because I feel that even though the episode is covering the Tynong murders and more victims, it was based on Catherine. It was based on Catherine because she was the youngest victim of them all, which is why she usually fronts most of this sort of publicity.
Yeah.
And I just don't know who it would affect to a point that someone had the power to put an injunction on it and stop it going to air when it was Catherine's friends that did it for a purpose. Do you know what I mean? And I feel that I don't have power on that, whereas I was involved in it, and I can't even find out who and why.
It could be some organisations that were named, possibly. I guess there must have been a pretty good reason for it not to.
Yeah, see,
air.
I'd so like to know that because, I don't, people have said what you've just said about it, and I don't see that. I see Catherine's friends trying to do something about sparking, you know, someone's memory. And that's all it is to me. I don't see that it implicates anyone or anything like that, whereas other people have said that they see that.
From what I saw, it was pretty eerie. Like the
what's your recollection of it? Can we talk about it? Even if it's weird that there's an injunction against it, and yet it's available on YouTube.
And I've never been told I can't talk about it, and I was involved in it, so I will.
We had to actually because we couldn't find it online anywhere, and in the end, we found it. It's actually been subtitled in German.
Yeah, it must have been played in Germany.
Yeah, so it's been aired in Germany. We ended up I downloaded it from somewhere like 6, 7, maybe even 8 years ago, The Last Goodbye. So if you YouTube it, you'll find it under that.
Yeah,
so.
And it's been shown, as Vicky just said, all around the place except for here where we need it.
And
like I said, I did it for a reason and I will talk about it until I'm told not to.
And it was a very good episode. It was really emotional. I think I had some email contact with one of the psychics when I was writing the book and they don't even know why it wasn't aired. I'm trying to remember if it was Scott or Deb, but they had no idea.
Yeah. What's your recollection of their investigation?
I was fascinated by Deb Webber because the only reason I ended up seeing her and being there when they were doing the recording with her was that they wanted some of Catherine's things or our things. They wanted a photo of her, I think earrings of hers. They had three things, but they had to come from John and I. And basically John and I both said, you don't get our stuff without one of us being with our stuff because, you know, over the years, if you've given someone something for a reason and you don't get it back or photo or whatever, I said, you don't get our stuff without us. So I took the things in with me and was there before Deb Webber got there and saw them actually put the photo and the earrings and things like that in the envelope. And I do remember there was three. I can't remember what was in the third one. And I saw them put them in there and I actually saw Deb with them and et cetera. And
if I'd just been someone watching that series at home, I would have been a bit more, oh, yeah, sure. But I actually saw how they handled this, and there was no checking it beforehand. She had no idea what was in those envelopes. She didn't do the old touchy-feely and try and work it out. She just,
oh, she had to guess, did she? Yeah, what was
well,
in
she
the
was handed the envelopes right. And see what she could get from it. So right. Just to sort of see that it wasn't fraudulent the way it was put across. It was done the way that it was shown. And she knew stuff she shouldn't have known. You know, she was having a conversation with Catherine, and if she got something wrong, she was corrected. And when I got home, I was quite devastated by it all, because if you know what she said was the part of the things that you knew were true, and then she sort of said how she was taken and stuff like that, if she's right, I went to hell and back that day. I was an absolute mess. And I got home and my brother was sort of saying, oh, I think it's a load of crap, this psychic stuff. And I just turned around to him and I said, my hair's not black, it's brown. I said, have you heard that before, Trev? And he said, yeah, Catherine used to say that. I said, that's what she said.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, she went to call her Kathy. And no, her name's Catherine. No one called her Kathy, Kath. It was always Catherine. You know, so anytime she was going down the wrong path,
yeah,
she was pulled up and she got it right. And like I said, if you believe her, I went to hell and back that day, and, you know, it just, and even I noticed that the crew were using my reactions to see how spot on she was as well. She couldn't see me and I wasn't with her, but they could see me, and you could tell, like, you know, where it was like, I'd go, oh, like this, then she'd correct it. And so, yeah, it sent me crazy for a while.
What did she say about the perpetrator? Did she have a theory as to who did it?
She did. There were no names mentioned or anything like that, but she did sort of, she felt that she was taken off the highway as well. And she ended up being right on the spot where Catherine's body was found as well.
Did she feel that she was taken by a stranger, by one person or more than one? Or
I'm not sure.
By two. Yeah. She felt that she was taken by two
and
people.
And strangers,
that she was actually forced into the car.
And thrown down to the
floor. Thrown down to the floor, held down.
You don't have to, you know, go into any details that you don't want to, but I was just wondering if she did get to a point where she thought, okay, this is the person or the perpetrator.
Yeah, well, she was basically saying she was dragged into the car by a second person. There was a driver, and thrown onto the floor where your feet go, and that's how she was held down, and no one saw her. So, like I said, she had a lot of facts that were facts.
Wow.
So the things that can't be proven as facts
Watching it as a friend and knowing Catherine and knowing John, you know, her boyfriend who was also in it, it just rang true what she was saying. You just go, my daughter and I sat there and watched it and I just cried the whole way through it, because she was so spot on with Catherine, with the way she was as a person and everything like that. So
and like feeling like she was communicating with Catherine.
Different. Definitely. Wow. It was quite spot on. And
And I think the other psychic on the show, Scott Russell Hill, he said that he felt strongly there were three killers operating separately, which would kind of be interesting because all the women ended up being dumped in the same place.
The stories of the other victims in this case are equally intriguing. For instance, 73-year-old Sunday school teacher Bertha Miller was approached by a strange man 2 weeks before her murder as she waited for a tram. He noticed the Bible she was carrying and struck up a conversation with her about Christianity. The man and the conversation were both interesting enough for Bertha to tell one of her friends about the encounter. Was this man her killer? You can read more about the other victims in this fascinating case in Emily's book, Suburban Nightmares. Just hit the Shop Now button on our Facebook page. It'd be really great if you could like us on Facebook while you're there and share some of our posts with your friends as well to help spread the word about our show. Thank you for downloading.